Why can't you lay off? I said to her. But she didn't even notice me. She leaned toward Willie and repeated coaxingly this time,
Are you, Willie?
He reached for the bottle and did it again.
Are you?
She demanded, not coaxing now. I was, he said, looking up at her, the blood in his face now, the tousle of hair hanging, his breath coming heavy. I was, he said, before, but I'm not now.
Not what?
She said. Not used to it.
You better get used to it,
she said and laughed and shoved the bottle in his direction. He took it, poured, drank, set the glass down deliberately and said, I better not. I better not get used to it. She laughed again, that wild artificial laugh, chopped off the laugh and echoed,
He says he better not get used to it. Oh, my God!
Then she laughed again. He sat there heavy in his chair, but not leaning back, the sweat beginning to pop out on his face and run down slow and shining over the flesh. He sat there, not noticing the sweat, not wiping it away, watching her laugh. All at once he heaved up out of the chair. I thought he was going to jump her. And she must have thought so too, for her laugh stopped, right in the middle of the aria. But he didn't jump her. He wasn't even looking at her. He flung his glance wide around the room and lifted his hands up in front of him, as though he were ready to grab something. I'll kill him, he said. I'll kill him. Sit down, she said, and leaned quickly toward him to give him a shove on the chest. His pegs weren't too steady, and he went down, right in the chair. I'll kill him, he said, sitting there, sweating.
You won't do a goddamn thing, she announced. You won't be governor, and you won't get paid for not being, and you won't kill them or anybody else, and you know why?
I'll kill him, he said.
I'll tell you why, she said, leaning. It's because you're a sap, a triple-plated, spoon-fed, one-gallus sap, and you...
I got up. I don't care what kind of games you play, I said, but I don't have to stay here and watch you. She didn't even turn her head. I went to the door and out, and the last I heard, she was defining what kind of a sap he was. I figured that that might take anybody some time. I took in a good deal of Upton that night. I saw the folks coming out of the last show at the Picture Palace, and I admired the cemetery gate and the schoolhouse by moonlight, and I leaned over the railing of the bridge over the creek and spit in the water. It took about 2 hours. Then I went back to the hotel. When I opened the door of the room, Sadie was sitting in a chair by the writing table smoking a cigarette. The air was thick enough to cut with a knife, and in the light of the lamp on the table, the blue smoke drifted and swayed and curdled around her, so that I got the impression I might have been looking at her sitting submerged in a tank full of soapy dishwater at the aquarium. The bottle on the table was empty. For a second or two, I thought that Willie had left. Then I saw the finished product. It was lying on my bed. I came in and shut the door. Things seem to have quieted down, I remarked.
Yeah.
I walked over to the bed and inspected the item. It was lying on its back. The coat was pushed up under the armpits. The hands were crossed piously on the bosom like the hands of a gisant on a tomb in a cathedral. The shirt had pulled up some from its moorings under the belt, and the two lowest buttons had come unbuttoned so that a triangular patch of slightly distended stomach was visible, white with a few coarse dark hairs. The mouth was parted a little, and the lower lip vibrated with a delicate flabbiness at each measured expulsion of breath. All very pretty.
He read around some, Sadie said, telling me what he was going to do, or he's going to do big things. He's going to be president. He's going to kill people with his bare hands. Oh, my God!
She took a drag on her cigarette and spewed the smoke out, and then fanned the backwash away from her face with a savage, slapping motion of her right hand.
But I quieted him down, she added, with an air of grim, suddenly spinsterish satisfaction, the kind your great aunt used to wear. Is he going to the barbecue? I asked. How the hell do I know? She snapped. He wasn't screaming about any little detail like a barbecue. Oh, he's a big operator. But... She paused and did the drag and spew and fanning routine. I quieted him. It looks like you slugged him, I observed. I didn't slug him, she said. But I hit him where he lives. I finally got across to him the kind of sap he is, and that quieted him. He's quiet now, all right, I said, and walked over toward the table. He didn't get that quiet all of a sudden, but he got quiet enough to sit in a chair and hang onto the bottle for support and talk about how he'd have to break the news to some goddamn Lucy. That's his wife, I said. He talked like it was his mammy and would blow his nose for him. Then he said he was going right to his room and write her a letter. But, she said and looked over at the bed, he never made it. He made the middle of the floor and then heaved for the bed. She rose from the chair and went over to the bed and looked down at him. Does Duffy know? I asked. I don't give a damn what Duffy knows, she said. I went over to the bed, too. I guess we'll have to leave him here, I said. I'll go over to his room and sleep. I leaned over and hunted for his room key in the pockets. I found it. Then I took a toothbrush and some pajamas out of my bag. She was still standing by the bed. She turned to me. Looks like you might at least take the bastard's shoes off, she said. I laid down my truck on the side of the bed and did it. I picked up the pajamas and toothbrush and went over to the table to switch off the lamp. Sadie was still by the bed. You better write that letter to that Mama Lucy, she said, and ask where to ship the remains. As I laid my hand on the switch, I looked back at Sadie standing there looking down at the remains, with the left arm, the arm toward me, hanging straight down and a cigarette hanging out of the tips of two fingers and unreeling its spinner of smoke slowly upward, and with her head leaning forward a little while she expelled smoke meditatively over her again outthrust and gleaming lower lip. There was Sadie, who had come a long way from the shanty in the mud flats. She had come a long way because she played to win, and she didn't mean to win matches. And she knew that to win you have to lay your money on the right number, and that if your number doesn't show, there's a fella standing right there with a little rake to rake in your money, and then it isn't yours anymore. She'd been around a long time, talking to men and looking them straight in the eye like a man. Some of them liked her, and those that didn't like her listened when she talked, which wasn't too often, because there was a reason to believe that when those big black eyes, which were black in a way which made it impossible for you to tell whether it was a blackness of surface or a blackness of depth, looked at the wheel before it began to move, they could see the way the wheel would be after it had ceased to move and saw the little ball on the number. Some of them liked her a lot, like Sen Sen. That had at one time been hard for me to get. I saw a package done up in the baggy tweed or droopy seersucker suit, according to the solstice, and the pocked face with the heavy smear of lipstick, and the black lamps in it, and above it the mob of black hair which looked as though it had been hacked off at ear length with a meat cleaver. Then one time, suddenly, I saw something else. You see a woman around for a long time and think that she is ugly. You think she's nothing. Then, all of a sudden, you think how she is under that baggy tweed or droopy seersucker. All of a sudden, you see the face which is there under the pockmarked mask and is humble, pure, and trusting, and is asking you to lift the mask. It must be like an old man looking at his wife and just for a second seeing the face he had seen 30 years before. Only in the case I'm talking about, it's not remembering a face which you have seen a long time back, but discovering a face which you have never seen. It is future, not past. It's very unsettling. It was very unsettling, temporarily. I made my pass, and it didn't come to a thing. She laughed in my face and said, I've got my arrangements, and I stick to my arrangements as long as I've got my arrangements.
I didn't know what the arrangements were. That was before the day of Mr. Sensen Puckett. That was before the day when she gave him the benefit of her gift for laying it on the right number. Nothing of this passed through my mind as I put my hand on the switch of the lamp and looked back at Sadie Burke. But I tell it in order that it may be known who the Sadie Burke was who stood by the bed meditating on the carcass as I laid my hand on the switch, and who had come the way she had come by not leading with her chin, but who had led with her chin that night. At least, that was the way I figured it. I turned the switch, and she and I went out the door and said good night in the hall. It must have been near 9 the next morning when Sadie beat on my door and I came swimming and swaying up from the bottom of a muddy sleep, like a piece of sogged driftwood stirred up from the bottom of a pond. I made the door and stuck my head out.
"Listen," she said without any build-up of civilities. "Duffy's going out to the fairgrounds, and I'll ride with him. He's got a lot of big-shotting to do out there. He wanted to get the sap out pretty early, too, to mingle with the common herd, but I told him he wasn't feeling too good, that he'd be out a little later."
"Okay," I said. "I'm not paid for it, but I'll try to deliver him."
"I don't care whether he ever gets there," she said. "It won't be skin off my nose."
"I'll try to get him there anyway."
"Suit yourself," she said,
and walked off down the hall, twitching the seersucker. I looked out the window and saw that it was going to be another day, and shaved and dressed and went down to get a cup of coffee. Then I went to my room and knocked. There was some kind of a sound inside, like an oboe blatting once deep inside a barrel of feathers. So I went in. I had left the door unlocked the night before. It was after 10 by that time. Willie was on the bed, in the same place, the coat still wadded up under his armpits, his hands still crossed on his chest, his face pale and pure. I went over to the bed. His head didn't turn, but his eyes swung toward me with a motion that made you think you could hear them creak in the sockets.
"Good morning," I said.
He opened his mouth a little way, and his tongue crept out and explored the lips carefully, wetting them. Then he grinned weakly, as though he were experimenting to see if anything would crack. Nothing happened, so he whispered,
"I reckon I was drunk last night."
"That's the name it goes by," I said.
"It's the first time," he said. "I never got drunk before. I never even tasted it but once before."
"I know. Lucy doesn't favor drinking."
"I reckon she'll understand, though, when I tell her," he said. "She'll see how it was I came to do it."
Then he sank into meditation.
"How do you feel?"
"I feel all right," he said, and pried himself up to a sitting posture, swinging his feet to the floor. He sat there with his sock feet on the floor, taking stock of the internal stresses and strains.
"Yeah," he concluded, "I feel all right."
"Are you going to the barbecue?" He looked up at me with a laborious motion of the head and an expression of question on his face, as though I were the fellow who was supposed to answer.
"What made you ask that?"
he demanded.
"Well, a lot's been happening."
"Yeah," he said, "I'm going." "Duffy and Sadie have already gone. Duffy wants you to come on out and mingle with the common herd."
"All right," he said.
Then, with his eyes fixed on an imaginary spot on the floor about 10 feet from his toes, he stuck his tongue out again and began to caress his lips.
"I'm thirsty," he said.
"You're dehydrated," I said, "the result of alcohol taken in excess. But that's the only way to take it. It's the only way to do a man any good." But he wasn't listening. He'd pulled himself up and padded off into the bathroom. I could hear the slosh of water and the gulping and inhaling. He must have been drinking out of the faucet. After about a minute, that sound stopped. There wasn't any sound at all for a spell, and then there was a new one. Then the agony was over. He appeared at the bathroom door, braced against the door jamb, staring at me with a face of sad reproach, bedewed with the glitter of cold sweat. You needn't look at me like that, I said. The liquor was all right.
I puked, he said wistfully.
Well, you didn't invent it. Besides, now you'll be able to eat a great big, hot, juicy, high-powered slab of barbecued hog meat. He didn't seem to think that that was very funny, and neither did I. But he didn't seem to think it was especially unfunny, either. He just hung on the door jamb, looking at me like a deaf and dumb stranger. Then he retired again into the bathroom.
I'll order you a pot of coffee, I yelled into him. It'll fix you up.
But it didn't. He took it, but it didn't even take time to make itself at home. Then he lay down for a while. I put a cold towel on his forehead, and he closed his eyes. He laid his hands on his breast, and the freckles on his face looked like rust spots on polished alabaster. About 11:15, the desk called to say that a car and two gentlemen were waiting to drive Mr. Stark to the fairgrounds. I put my hand over the receiver and looked over at Willie. His eyes had come open and were fixed on the ceiling.
What the hell you want to go to that barbecue for? I said.
I'm going to tell him to his tail.
I'm going to the barbecue, he announced from the spirit world, his eyes still fixed on the ceiling. So I went down to the lobby to stall off two of the local semi-leading citizens who'd even agreed to ride in the gubernatorial hearse to get their names in the paper. I stalled them. I said Mr. Stark was slightly indisposed and I would drive him out in about an hour. At 12 o'clock, I tried the coffee treatment again. It didn't work. Or rather, it worked wrong. Duffy called up from out at the fairgrounds and wanted to know what the hell. I told him he'd better go on and distribute the loaves and fishes and pray God for Willie to arrive by 2 o'clock.
What's the matter? Demanded Duffy.
Boy, I said, the longer you don't know, the happier you'll be, and hung up the phone. Along toward 1, after Willie had made another effort to recuperate with coffee and had failed, I said,
Look here, Willie, what are you going out there for? Why don't you stay here? Send word you are sick and spare yourself some grief. Then later on, if...
No, he said, and pushed himself up to a sitting position on the side of the bed. His face had a high and pure and transparent look, like a martyr's face just before he steps into the flame. Well, I said without enthusiasm, if you're hell-bent, you got one more chance.
More coffee? He asked.
No, I said, and unstrapped my suitcase and got out the second bottle. I poured some in a tumbler and took it to him. According to the old folks, I said, the best way is to put 2 shots of absinthe on a little cracked ice and float on a shot of rye, but we can't be fancy, not with prohibition. He got it down. There was a harrowing moment, then I drew a sigh of relief. In 10 minutes, I repeated the dose. Then I told him to get undressed while I ran a tub of cold water. While he was in the tub, I called down for the desk to get us a car. Then I went to Willie's room to get some clean clothes and his other suit. He managed to get dressed, taking time out now and then for me to give a treatment. He got dressed and then sat on the edge of the bed wearing a big label marked, Handle with care, this end up, fragile. But I got him down to the car. Then I had to go back up and get a copy of his speech, which he'd left in his top bureau drawer. He might need it, he said, after I got back. He might not be able to remember very well and might have to read it. All about Peter Rabbit and Wally Woodchuck, I said, but he wasn't attending. He lay back and closed his eyes while the tumbril bumped over the gravel toward the fairgrounds. I looked up the road and saw the flowers and wagons and buggies ranked on the outskirts of a grove, and the fair buildings, and an American flag draped around a staff against the blue sky. Then, above the sound of our coffee grinder, I caught the strains of music. Duffy was soothing the digestion of the multitude. Willie put out his hand and laid it on the flask.
"Gimme that thing," he said.
"Go easy," I said. "You aren't used to this stuff. You already..." But he had it to his mouth by that time, and the sound of it gargling down would have drowned the sound of my words even if I had kept on wasting them. When he handed the thing back to me, there wasn't enough in it to make it worth my while putting it in my pocket. What collected in one corner when I tilted it wouldn't make even a drink for a high school girl.
You sure you don't want to finish it?
I asked, in mock politeness. He shook his head in a dazed sort of way, said, "No, thanks," and then shivered like a man with a hard chill. So I took what was left and threw the empty pint bottle out of the window. "Drive in as close as you can," I told the boy at the wheel. He got in pretty close, and I got out and gave Willie a hand and paid the kid off. Then Willie and I drifted slowly over the brown and trodden grass toward a platform while the crowd about us was as nothing, and Willie's eyes were on far horizons, and the band played Casey Jones. I left Willie in the lee of the platform, standing all alone in a space of brown grass in a strange country with a dream on his face and the sun beating down on him. I found Duffy and said, "I'm ready to make delivery, but I want a receipt."
"What's the matter with him?" Duffy wanted to know. "The bastard doesn't drink. Is he drunk?"
"He never touches this stuff," I said. "It's just he's been on the road to Damascus and he saw a great light and he's got the blind staggers."
"What's the matter with him?"
"You ought to read the good book more," I told Duffy and led him to the candidate. It was a touching reunion, so I melted into the throng. There was quite a crowd, for the scent of burning meat on the air will do wonders. The folks were beginning to collect around in front of the platform and climb up in the grandstand. The local band was standing over to one side of the platform, now working over "Hail, Hail, the Gang's All Here." On the platform were the two local boys who didn't have any political future, who had come to the hotel that morning, and another fellow who was, by my guess, a preacher to offer up a prayer, and Duffy. And there was Willie, sweating slow. They sat in a row of chairs across the back of the platform, in front of the bunting-draped backdrop, and behind a bunting-draped table on which was a big pitcher of water and a couple of glasses. One of the local boys got up first and addressed his friends and neighbors and introduced the preacher, who addressed God Almighty, with his gaunt, raw-boned face lifted up above the blue surge and his eyes squinched into the blazing light. Then the first local boy got up and worked around to introducing the second local boy. It looked for a while as though the second local boy was the boy with the button after all, for he was, apparently, built for endurance and not speed. But it turned out that he didn't really have the button any more than the first local boy, or the preacher, or God Almighty. It just took him longer to admit that he didn't have it and to put the finger on Willie. Then Willie stood all alone by the table, saying, "My friends," and turning his alabaster face precariously from one side to the other and fumbling in the right side pocket of his coat to fish out the speech. While he was fumbling with the sheets and looking down at them with a slightly bemused expression, as though the stuff before him were in a foreign language, somebody tugged at my sleeve. There was Sadie.
"How was it?" she asked.
"Take a look and guess," I replied. She gave a good look up to the platform and then asked,
"How'd you do it?"
"Hair of the dog." She looked up at the platform again.
"Hair, hell," she said. "He must have swallowed the dog."
I inspected Willie, who stood up there sweating and swaying and speechless under the hot sun.
"He's on the ropes," Sadie said.
"Hell, he's been on 'em all morning," I said. "And lucky to have him." She was still looking at him. It was much the way she had looked at him the night before when he lay on the bed in my room, out cold, and she stood by the side of the bed. It wasn't pity, and it wasn't contempt. It was an ambiguous, speculative look. Then she said, "Maybe he was born on him." She said it in a tone which seemed to imply that she had settled that subject. But she kept on looking up there at him in the same way. The candidate could still stand, at least with one thigh propped against the table. He had begun to talk by this time, too. He had called them his friends in two or three ways and had said he was glad to be there. Now he stood there clutching the manuscript in both hands with his head lowered like a dehorned cow beset by a couple of fierce dogs in the barnyard while the sun beat on him and the sweat dropped. Then he took a grip on himself and lifted his head.
I have a speech here, he said. It's a speech about what this state needs. But there's no use telling you what this state needs. You are the state. You know what you need. Look at your pants. Have they got holes in the knee? Listen to your belly. Did it ever rumble for emptiness? Look at your crop. Did it ever rot in the field because the road was so bad you couldn't get it to market? Look at your kids. Are they growing up ignorant as you and dirt because there isn't any school for them? Willie paused and blinked around at the crowd. Now, he said, I'm not going to read you any speech. You know what you need better than I could tell you. But I'm going to tell you a story. And he paused, steadied himself by the table, and took a deep breath while the sweat dripped. I leaned toward Sadie. What the hell's the bugger up to? I asked. Shut up, she commanded, watching him. He began again. It's a funny story, he said. Get ready to laugh. Get ready to bust your sides, for it's sure a funny story. It's about a hick. It's about a redneck, like you all, if you please. Yeah, like you. He grew up like any other mother's son on the dirt roads and gully washes of a North State farm. He knew all about being a hick. He knew what it was to get up before day and get cow dung between his toes and feed and slop and milk before breakfast so he could set off by sunup to walk 6 miles to a one-room slab-sided schoolhouse. He knew what it was to pay high taxes for that windy shack of a schoolhouse and those gully-washed red clay roads to walk over, or to break his wagon axle or string halt his mules on. Oh, he knew what it was to be a hick summer and winter. He figured if he wanted to do anything, he had to do it himself. So he sat up nights and studied books and studied law so maybe he could do something about changing things. He didn't study that law in any man's school or college. He studied it nights after a hard day's work in the field so he could change things some, for himself and for folks like him. I'm not lying to you. He didn't start out thinking about all the other hicks and how he was going to do wonderful things for them. He started out thinking of number one. But something came to him on the way. How he could not do something for himself and not for other folks or for himself without the help of other folks. It was going to be all together or none. That came to him. And it came to him with the powerful force of God's own lightning on a tragic time back in his own home county 2 years ago when the first brick schoolhouse ever built in his county collapsed because it was built of politics rotten brick and it killed and mangled a dozen poor little scholars. Oh, you know that story. He had fought the politics back of building that schoolhouse of rotten brick, but he lost and it fell. But it started him thinking next time would be different. People were his friends because he'd fought that rotten brick, and some of the public leaders down in the city knew that, and they rode up to his pappy's place in a big fine car and said how they wanted him to run for governor. I plucked Sadie's arm. You think he's gonna... Shut up, she said savagely. I looked toward Duffy up there on the platform back of Willie. Duffy's face was worried. It was red and round and sweating, and it was worried. Oh, they told him, Willie was saying, and that hick swallowed it. He looked in his heart and thought he might try to change things. In all humility, he thought how he might try. He was just a human country boy who believed like we have always believed back here in the hills that even the plainest, poorest fella can be governor if his fellow citizens find he's got the stuff and the character for the job. Those fellas in the striped pants saw the hick and they took him in. They said how McMurphy was a limber back and a dead head and how Joe Harrison was the tool of the city machine and how they wanted that hick to step in and try to give some honest government. They told him that. But Willie stopped and lifted his right hand, clutching the manuscript to high heaven. Do you know who they were? They were Joe Harrison's hired hands and lick spittles, and they wanted to get a hick to run to split McMurphy's hick vote. Did I guess this? I did not. No, for I heard their sweet talk, and I wouldn't know the truth this minute if that woman right there, and he pointed down at Sadie,
If that woman right there...
I nudged Sadie and said, "Sister, you are out of a job."
If that fine woman right there hadn't been honest enough and decent enough to tell the foul truth which stinks in the nostrils of the Most High.
Duffy was on his feet, edging uncertainly toward the front of the platform. He kept looking desperately toward the band as though he might signal them to burst into music, and then at the crowd as though he were trying to think of something to say. Then he edged toward Willie and said something to him. But the words, whatever they were scarcely out of his mouth before Willie had turned on him.
"There!" Willie roared. "There!"
And he waved his right hand, the hand clutching the manuscript of his speech.
"There is the Judas Iscariot, the lick spittle, the nose wiper."
And Willie waved his right arm at Duffy, clutching the manuscript which he had not read. Duffy was trying to say something to him, but Willie wasn't hearing it, for he was waving the manuscript under Duffy's retreating nose and shouting,
"Look at him! Look at him!"
Duffy, still retreating, looked toward the band and waved his arms at them and shouted,
"Play, play, play the Star-Spangled Banner!"
But the band didn't play. And just then, as Duffy turned back to Willie, Willie made a more than usually energetic pass of the fluttering manuscript under Duffy's nose and shouted,
"Look at him, Joe Harrison's dummy!"
Duffy shouted, "It's a lie!" and stepped back from the accusing arm. I don't know whether Willie meant to do it, but anyway, he did it. He didn't exactly shove Duffy off the platform. He just started Duffy doing a dance along the edge, a kind of delicate, feather-toed, bemused, slow-motion adagio accompanied by arms pinwheeling around a face which was like a surprised custard pie with a hole scooped in the middle of the meringue, and the hole was Duffy's mouth, but no sound came out of it. There wasn't a sound over that five-acre tract of sweating humanity. They just watched Duffy do his dance. Then he danced right off the platform. He broke his fall and half lay, half sat, propped against the bottom of the platform with his mouth still open. No sound came out of it now, for there wasn't any breath to make a sound. All of that and me without a camera. Willie hadn't even bothered to look over the edge.
"Let the hog lie," he shouted. "Let the hog lie and listen to me, you hicks. Yeah, you're hicks, too, and they fooled you, too, 1,000 times just like they fooled me. For that's what they think we're for, to fool. Well, this time I'm gonna fool somebody. I'm getting out of this race, and you know why?"
He paused and wiped the sweat off his face with his left hand, a flat, scouring motion.
"Not because my little feelings are hurt. They aren't hurt. I never felt better in my life, 'cause now I know the truth. What I ought have known long back. Whatever a hick wants, he's got to do for himself. Nobody in a fine automobile and sweet talking is going to do it for him. When I come back to run for governor again, I'm coming on my own and I'm coming for blood. But I'm getting out now. I'm resigning in favor of McMurphy. By God, everything I've said about McMurphy stands, and I'll say it again, but I'm going to stump this state for him. Me and the other hicks, we're going to kill Joe Harrison so dead he'll never even run for dog catcher in this state. Then we'll see what McMurphy does. This is his last chance. The time has come. The truth is going to be told, and I'm going to tell it. I'm going to tell it over this state from one end to the other if I have to ride the rods or steal me a mule to do it, and no man, Joe Harrison or any other man, can stop me. For I got me a gospel, and I..."
I leaned to Sadie. "Listen," I said, "I've got to get on a telephone. I'm starting to town on the first telephone I hit. I got to telephone this in. You stay here and for God's sake remember what happens." "All right," she said, not paying much mind to me. "And nab Willie when it's over and bring him to town. It's a sure thing Duffy won't ask you to ride with him. You nab the sap and..."
"Sap hell,"
she said, and added, "You go on." I went. I worked around the edge of the grandstand, through the crowd, with the sound of Willie's voice hammering on the eardrums and shaking dead leaves off the oak trees. As I rounded the end of the grandstand, I looked back, and there was Willie flinging the sheets of his manuscript from him so they swirled about his feet and beating on his chest and shouting how the truth was there and didn't need writing down. There he was, with the papers about his feet and one arm up, the coat sleeve jammed elbow high, face red as a bruised beet, and the sweat sluicing, hair over his forehead, eyes bugged out and shining, drunk as a hoot owl, and behind him the bunting, red, white, and blue, and over him God's bright, brassy, incandescent sky. I walked down the gravel road a piece and hitched a ride on a truck to town. That night, when all was still and the train bearing Duffy back to the city, to report no doubt to Joe Harrison, was puffing across the sage country under the stars, and Willie had been in bed for hours, sleeping off the fumes, I reached for the bottle on the writing table in my room at the hotel in Upton and said to Sadie, "How about a little more of the stuff that let the bars down and kicked the boards loose?" "What?" she asked. "You wouldn't understand that to which I so grammatically refer," I said, and poured the drink for her. "Oh, I forgot," she said. "You're the fella who went to college." Yes, I was the fella who had gone so grammatically to college, where I had not learned, I decided, all there was to know.
This ends Disc 4. All the King's Men, Disc 5.
Willie kept his word. He stumped the state from McMurphy. He didn't ride the rods or buy him a mule or steal him one, but he drove the pants off his pretty good second-hand car over the washboard and through the hub-deep dust and got mired in the black gumbo when a rain came and sat in his car waiting for the span of mules to come and pull him out. He stood on schoolhouse steps and on the top of boxes borrowed from the dry goods store and on the seats of farm wagons and on the porches of crossroads stores and talked. "Friends, rednecks, suckers, and fella hicks," he would say, leaning forward, leaning at them, looking at them. And he would pause, letting the words sink in. And in the quiet, the crowd would be restless and resentful under these words, the words they knew people called them, but the words nobody ever got up and called them to their face. "Yeah," he would say, "yeah," and twist his mouth on the word. "That's what you are, and you needn't get mad at me for telling you. Well, get mad, but I'm telling you. That's what you are. And me? I'm one, too. Oh, I'm a redneck, for the sun has beat down on me. Oh, I'm a sucker, for I fell for that sweet-talking fella in the fine automobile. Oh, I took the sugar tit and hushed my crying. Oh, I'm a hick, and I'm the hick they were going to try to use and split the hick vote. But I'm standing here on my own hind legs, for even a dog can learn to do that, give him time. I learned. It took me a time, but I learned, and here I am on my own hind legs." And he would lean at them and demand, Are you on your hind legs? Have you learned that much yet? You think you can learn that much?" He told them things they didn't like. He called them the names they didn't like to be called, but always, almost always, the restlessness and resentment died, and he leaned at them with his eyes bugging and his face glistening in the hot sunlight or the red light of a gasoline flare. They listened while he told them to stand on their own hind legs. "Go and vote," he told them. "Vote for McMurphy this time," he told them, "for he's all you've got to vote for. But vote strong, strong enough to show what you can do. Vote him in, and then if he doesn't deliver, nail up his hide." "Yeah," he would say, leaning. "Yeah, nail him up if he don't deliver. Hand me the hammer and I'll nail him." "Vote," he told them. "Put McMurphy on the spot," he told them. He leaned at them and said, "Listen to me, you hicks. Listen here and lift up your eyes and look on the God's blessed and unfly-blown truth. If you got the brain of a sapsucker left and can recognize the truth when you see it, this is the truth. You are a hick, and nobody ever helped a hick but the hick himself. Up there in town, they won't help you. It's up to you and God helps those who help themselves." He gave them that, and they stood there in front of him, with a thumb hooked in the overall strap, and the eyes under the pulled-down hat brim squinting at him, as though he were something spied across a valley or cove,
something they weren't quite easy in the mind about. Too far away to make out good, or a sudden movement in the brush seen way off yonder across the valley or across the field, and something might pop out of the brush, and under the eyes, the jaw revolving worked the quid with a slow, punctilious, immitigable motion like historical process. And time is nothing to a hog, or to history either. They watched him, and if you watched close, you might be able to see something beginning to happen. They stand so quiet, they don't even shift from one foot to the other. They've got a talent for being quiet. You can see them stand on the street corner when they come to town, not moving or talking, or see one of them squatting on his heels by the road, just looking off where the road drops over the hill. And their squinched eyes don't flicker off the man up there in front of them. They've got a talent for being quiet. But sometimes the quietness stops. It snaps all of a sudden, like a piece of string pulled tight. One of them sits quiet on the bench at the Brush Arbor Revival, listening. And all of a sudden he jumps up and lifts up his arms and yells, "Oh, Jesus, I have seen his name!" Or one of them presses his finger on the trigger and the sound of the gun surprises even him. Willie is up there, in the sun or in the red light of the gasoline flare. "You ask me what my program is? Here it is, you hicks, and don't you forget it. Nail 'em up. Nail up Joe Harrison. Nail up anybody who stands in your way. Nail up McMurphy if he don't deliver. Nail up anybody who stands in your way. You hand me the hammer and I'll do it with my own hand. Nail 'em up on the barn door, and don't fan away the blue bottles with any turkey wing." It was Willie, all right. It was the fellow with the same name. McMurphy was elected. Willie had something to do with it, for the biggest vote was polled in the sections Willie had worked that they had any record of. But all the time, McMurphy didn't know quite what to make of Willie. He shied off him at first, for Willie had said some pretty hard things about him. And then, when it did look as though Willie would make an impression, he shilly-shallied. And in the end, Willie got up on his hind legs and said how the McMurphy people were offering to pay his expenses, but he was on his own. He wasn't McMurphy's man, even if he was saying to vote for McMurphy. He was paying his way, he said, even if he had to put another mortgage on his pappy's farm and the last one it would hold. Yes, and if there was anybody who couldn't afford $2 to pay his poll tax and came to him and said it straight out, he, Willie Stark, would pay that tax out of money he had got by mortgaging his pappy's farm. That was how much he believed in what he was saying. McMurphy was in, and Willie went back to Mason City and practiced law. He must have dragged on for a year or so, handling chicken-stealing cases and stray hog cases and cutting scrapes, which are part of the entertainment at Saturday night square dances in Mason County. Then a gang of workmen got hurt when some of the rig collapsed on a bridge the state was building over the Ocmulgee River, and two or three got killed. A lot of the workmen were from Mason County, and they got Willie for their lawyer. He got all over the papers for that, and he won the case. Then they struck oil just west of Mason County over in Ocmulgee County, and in that section, Willie got mixed up in the litigation between an oil company and some independent leaseholders. Willie's side won, and he saw folding money for the first time in his life. He saw quite a lot of it. During all that time, I didn't see Willie. I didn't see him again until he announced in the Democratic primary in 1930. But it wasn't a primary. It was hell among the yearlings and the charge of the Light Brigade, and Saturday night in the back room of Casey's saloon rolled into one. And when the smoke cleared away, not a picture still hung on the walls. And there wasn't any Democratic Party. There was just Willie, with his hair in his eyes and his shirt sticking to his stomach with sweat. And he had a meat axe in his hand and was screaming for blood. In the background of the picture, under a purplish, tumbled sky flecked with sinister white like driven foam, flanking Willie, one on each side, were two figures, Sadie Burke and a tallish, stooped, slow-spoken man with a sad, tanned face and what they call the eyes of a dreamer. The man was Hugh Miller, Harvard Law School, Lafayette Escadrille, Croix de Guerre, clean hands, pure heart, and no political past. He was a fellow who had sat still for years, and then somebody, Willie Stark, handed him a baseball bat and he felt his fingers close on the tape. He was a man and was Attorney General.
and Sadie Burke was just Sadie Burke. Over the brow of the hill, there were, of course, some other people. There were, for instance, certain gentlemen who had once been devoted to Joe Harrison, but who, when they discovered that there wasn't going to be any more Joe Harrison, politically speaking, had had to hunt up a new friend. The new friend happened to be Willie. He was the only place for them to go. They figured they would sign on with Willie and grow up with the country. Willie signed them on, all right, and as a result got quite a few votes, not of the wool hat and cockleburr variety. After a while, Willie even signed on Tiny Duffy, who became highway commissioner and later lieutenant governor in Willie's last term. I used to wonder why Willie kept him around. Sometimes I used to ask the boss, "What do you keep that lunkhead for?" Sometimes he'd just laugh and say nothing. Sometimes he'd say, "Hell, somebody's got to be lieutenant governor, and they all look alike." But once he said, "I keep him because he reminds me of something." "What?" "Something I don't ever want to forget," he said. "What's that?" "That when they come to you sweet-talking, you better not listen to anything they say. I don't aim to forget that." So that was it. Tiny was the fellow who had come in a big automobile and had talked sweet to Willie back when Willie was a little country lawyer. But was that it? Or rather, was that all of it? I figured there was another reason. The boss must have taken a kind of pride in the fact that he could make Tiny Duffy a success. He had busted Tiny Duffy, and then he had picked up the pieces and put him back together again as his own creation. He must have taken a lot of pleasure in looking at Tiny's glittering rig and diamond ring, and thinking that it was all hollow, that it was a sham, that if he should crook his little finger, Tiny Duffy would disappear like a whiff of smoke. In a way, the very success which the boss laid on Tiny was his revenge on Tiny, for every time the boss put his meditative, sleepy, distant gaze on Tiny, Tiny would know, with a cold clutch at his fat heart, that if the boss should crook a finger, there wouldn't be anything but the whiff of smoke. In a way, Tiny's success was a final index of the boss's own success. But was that it? In the end, I decided that there was one more reason behind the other reasons. This: Tiny Duffy became, in a crazy kind of way, the other self of Willie Stark, and all the contempt and insult which Willie Stark was to heap on Tiny Duffy was nothing but what one self of Willie Stark did to the other self because of a blind, inward necessity. But I came to that conclusion only at the very end, a long time afterwards. But now Willie had just become governor, and nobody knew what would come afterwards. And meanwhile, while the campaign was on, I was out of a job. My job had been political reporting for the Chronicle. I had a column, too. I was a pundit. One day, Jim Madison had me in to stand on the Kelly Green carpet which surrounded his desk like a pasture. "Jack," he said, "you know what the Chronicle line is in this election?" "Sure," I replied. "It wants to elect Sam McMurphy again because of his brilliant record as an administrator and his high integrity as a statesman." He grinned a little sourly and said, "It wants to elect Sam McMurphy." "I'm sorry, I forgot we were in the bosom of the family. I thought I was writing my column." The grin went off his face. He played with a pencil on his desk. "It's about the column I wanted to see you," he said. "Okay," I replied. "Can't you put some more steam in it? This is an election and not a meeting of the Epworth League." "It is an election, all right." "Can't you give it a little more?" "When what you got to work with is Sam McMurphy," I said, "you haven't even got a sow's ear to make a silk purse out of. I'm doing what I can." He brooded over that for a minute. Then he began, "Now, just because that Stark happens to be a friend of yours, you..." "He's no friend of mine," I snapped. "I didn't even see him between last election and this one. Personally, I don't care who is ever governor of this state or how big a son of a bitch he is. But I am a hired hand, and I do my best to suppress in my column my burning conviction that Sam McMurphy is one of the fanciest sons of..." "You know the Chronicle line," Jim Madison said heavily, and studied the spit-slick, chewed butt of his cigar. It was a hot day, and the breeze from the electric fan was all on Jim Madison and not on me, and there was a little thread of acid-yellow-feeling saliva down in my throat, the kind you get when your stomach is sour, and my head felt like a dried gourd with a couple of seeds rattling around in it. So I looked at Jim Madison and said, "All right." "What do you mean?" he asked. "I mean it the way I said it," I said, and started for the door. "Look here, Jack, I'm..." he began and laid the cigar butt down on the ashtray. "I know," I said, "you've got a wife and kids and your boys in Princeton." I said that and kept on walking. There was a water cooler outside the door in the hall, and I stopped by it and took one of the little cone-shaped cups and drank about 10 of them full of ice water to wash the yellow thing out of my throat. Then I stood there in the hall with my stomach full of the water like a cold bulb inside of me. I could sleep late, and then wake up and not move, just watching the hot, melted butter-colored sunlight pour through the cracks in the shade, for my hotel was not the best in town, and my room was not the best in the hotel. As my chest rose and fell with my breathing, the sheet would stick damply to my bare hide, for that is the way you sleep there in the summertime. I could hear the streetcars and the blatting of automobile horns off yonder, not too loud, but variegated and unremitting, a kind of coarse, hoarse, tweedy mixture of sounds to your nerve ends, and occasionally the clatter of dishes, for my room gave on the kitchen area, and now and then a nigger would sing a snatch down there. I could lie there as long as I wanted, and let all the pictures of things a man might want run through my head. Coffee, a girl, money, a drink, white sand and blue water, and let them all slide off one after another like a deck of cards slewing slowly off your hand. Maybe the things you want are like cards. You don't want them for themselves, really, though you think you do. You don't want a card because you want the card, but because in a perfectly arbitrary system of rules and values, and in a special combination of which you already hold a part, the card has meaning. But suppose you aren't sitting in a game. Then, even if you do know the rules, a card doesn't mean a thing. They all look alike. So I could lie there, though I knew I would get up after a spell, not deciding to get up, but just all at once finding myself standing in the middle of the floor, just as later on I would find myself, with a mild shock of recognition, taking coffee, changing a bill, handling a girl, drawing on a drink, floating in the water. Like an amnesia case playing solitaire in a hospital, I would get up and deal myself a hand all right, later on. But for the present I would lie there and know I didn't have to get up and feel the holy emptiness and blessed fatigue of a saint after the dark night of the soul. For God and nothing have a lot in common. You look either one of them straight in the eye for a second, and the immediate effect on the human constitution is the same. Lots of nights I would go to bed early, too. Sometimes sleep gets to be a serious and complete thing. You stop going to sleep in order that you may be able to get up, but get up in order that you may be able to go back to sleep. You get so during the days you catch yourself suddenly standing still and waiting and listening. You're like a little boy at the railroad station, ready to go away on the train which hasn't come yet. You look way up the track but can't see the little patch of black smoke yet. You fidget around, but all at once you stop in the middle of your fidgeting and listen. You can't hear it yet. Then you go and kneel down in your Sunday clothes in the cinders, for which your mother is going to snatch you bald-headed, and put your ear to the rail and listen for the first soundless rustle which will come in the rail long before the little black patch begins to grow on the sky. You get so you listen for night, long before it comes over the horizon, and long, long before it comes charging and stewing and thundering to you like a big black locomotive, and the black cars grind to a momentary stop, and the porter with the black shining face helps you up the steps and says, "Yes, sir, little boss, yes, sir." You don't dream in that kind of sleep, but you're aware of it every minute you are asleep, as though you were having a long dream of sleep itself. And in that sleep you were dreaming of sleep, sleeping and dreaming of sleep infinitely inward into the center. That was the way it was for a while after I didn't have any job. It wasn't new. It had been like that before, twice before. I had even given a name to it, the Great Sleep. The time before I quit the university, just a few months before I was supposed to finish my dissertation for the PhD in American history. It was almost finished, and they said it was okay. The sheets of typed-on paper were stacked up on the table by the typewriter. The boxes of cards were there. I would get up late in the morning and see them there, the top sheet of paper beginning to curl up around the paperweight. And I'd see them there when I came in after supper to go to bed. Finally, one morning, I got up late and went out the door and didn't come back and left them there. And the other time the Great Sleep had come was the time before I walked out of the apartment and Lois started to get the divorce. But this time there wasn't any American history and there wasn't any Lois. But there was the Great Sleep. When I did get up, I just piddled around. I went to movies and hung around speakeasies and went swimming or went out to the country club and lay on the grass and watched a couple of hot bastards swing rackets at a little white ball that flashed in the sun. Or perhaps one of the players would be a girl, and the short white skirt would swirl and whip about her brown thighs and flash in the sun, too. A few times I went to see Adam Stanton at his apartment, the fellow I had grown up with at Burden's Landing. He was a hot-shot surgeon now, with more folks screaming for him to cut on them than he had time to cut on, and a professor at the University Medical School, and busy grinding out the papers he published in the scientific journals or took off to read at meetings in New York and Baltimore and London. He wasn't married. He didn't have time, he said. He didn't have time for anything. But he'd take a little time to let me sit in a shabby, overstuffed chair in his shabby apartment, where papers were stacked around and the colored girl had streaked the dust on the furniture. I used to wonder why he lived the way he did, when he must have been having quite a handsome take, but I finally got it through my head that he didn't ask anything from a lot of the folks he cut on. He had the name of a softy in the trade, and after he got money, people took him for it if they had a story that would halfway wash. The only thing in his apartment that was worth a plug nickel was a piano, and it was the best money could buy. Most of the time when I was at Adam's apartment, he would be at the piano. I have heard it said that he was pretty good, but I wouldn't know. But I didn't mind listening, not if the chair was good and comfortable. Adam must have heard me say one time or another that music didn't mean much to me, but I suppose that he'd forgotten it or couldn't believe that it was true for anybody. Anyway, he would turn his head at me and say, "This, now listen to this. My God, this now is sure a..." But his voice would trail off, and the words, which were going to tell what the thing sure and eternally was in its blessed truth, would not ever get said. He would just leave the sentence hanging and twisting slowly in the air like a piece of frayed rope, and would look at me out of his clear, deep-set, ice-water blue, abstract eyes, the kind of eyes and the kind of look your conscience has about 3 o'clock in the morning. And then, unlike your conscience, he would begin to smile, not much, just a sort of a tentative, almost apologetic smile that took the curse off that straight mouth and square jaw and seemed to say, "Hell, I can't help it if I look at you that way, buddy. It's just the way I look at things." Then the smile would be gone, and he would turn his face to the piano and set his hands to the keys. Sooner or later, he would get enough of the music and would drop into one of the other shabby chairs. Or he might remember to get me a drink, or might even take one himself, paler than winter sunlight and about as strong. We'd sit there, not talking, sipping slow, his eyes burning cold and blue in his head, bluer because of the swarthiness of the skin, which was drawn back taut over the bones of the face. It was like when we used to go fishing when we were kids, back at Burden's Landing. We used to sit in the boat under the hot sun hour after hour and never a word, or lie on the beach, or go camping together and after supper lie by a little smudge fire for the mosquitoes and never say a word. Perhaps Adam didn't mind taking a little time out for me because I made him think back to Burden's Landing and the other days. Not that he talked about it, but once he did. He was sitting in the chair, looking down at the eyewash in the glass, which his long, hard-looking, nervous fingers were slowly revolving. Then he looked up at me and said, "We used to have a pretty good time, didn't we, when we were kids?" "Yeah," I said. "You and me and Anne," he said. "Yeah," I said, and thought of Anne. Then I said, "Don't you have a good time now?" He seemed to take the question under advisement for a half a minute, as though I had asked him a real